I have a message from another time. Airy Productions Unlimited presents Undocumented Features Future Imperfect, Symphony of the Sword. Third movement, A Rose for the New Year, by Benjamin D. Hutchins. Hi, that's me. Christmas Day came bright and clear, the previous night's snow smooth and unbroken on the hills and yards of Morgan Lane. True to Kay's warning, Sylvie Daniels did, indeed, pretty much wake the house with her boisterous arrival, which apparently involved waking the Morgan twins with hands chilled in the snow outside. A bit of noise and confusion ensued until finally the whole ship's company was turned to in the living room. The ship of household's supposed captain, Ben Hutchins, known to all as Griffin, his wife and ostensible exec, Kay Morgan, their eldest daughter, Caitlin Hutchins, her school roommate and best friend Utena Tenjo, Utena's former and most likely future schoolmate Miki Kaworu, Kate's brothers Leonard Hutchins and Corwin Ravenhair, Corwin's self-professed boon companion Noel Silverclaw, who claimed to be a dragon but who looked more like a flying cat, and of course the twins, Pris and Guy, still looking a bit annoyed at their rather rude awakening. Everyone was disheveled and yawning, but bright-eyed. Well, Corwin was looking a bit fried, but he came down from his room instead of up from the basement, so he must have gotten some sleep after pulling his second all-nighter in a row to finish up what he would only describe as an important project. Griffin bustled about with hot cocoa and little marshmallows. Kay delighted all assembled by starting a fire in the fireplace with a zot from her cosmic rod. The crew said their good mornings to each other, settled into places around the big, gaily decorated Christmas tree, and settled down to the serious business of gifts. First, there were the big, fuzzy red stockings, which had been carefully removed from the mantle before Kay lit the fire. Everybody had one. From somewhere, Griffin and Kay had even found one for Miki, short notice and all. Each contained a couple of stock items. It seemed traditional, for instance, that the toe of each be stuffed with an orange to give it that proper weight and hang angle, and also that each be equipped with a bottle of dry-roasted cashew nuts. Further space was filled out by various small candies, batteries, and such small essentials. Other things were more individually tailored. Pris, for instance, received several power packs and a spare collimator crystal for the new blaster she'd received as her one Christmas Eve present, while Kate's had a new set of strings for her guitar, a very small tiger, a new whetstone, and a harmonica. The others all had similarly tailored bits, and they sat around comparing notes and chattering happily, a warm, congenial gang, until everyone was finished and it was time to start pulling things from under the tree and opening them. There was no formal rotation now as there had been the previous evening. Just a gleeful free-for-all of tearing paper, scattering ribbons, and delighted exclamations. Books were a very popular item in this house, which Utena had guessed might be the case, given the number of well-populated bookshelves in it. Even Noll got a book, a large, imposing, and handsome volume in gilt-edged parchment and tooled leather. Its text appeared to be handwritten in an extremely angular script, and it had many lavish pen and ink illustrations of, what else? Dragons. Noll declared it the finest copy of the great draconic codex he'd ever seen, and thanked Corwin profusely for it. Corwin, Utena was amused and pleased to see, was wearing the silver rose brooch she'd given him the day before, though it looked a little out of place affixed to the top pocket of his pajamas. And what pajamas they were, too! Black silk with silver buttons and edging, with a relaxed but refined cut, as timeless as an Armani suit. They were almost formal in their simplicity, nearly elegant enough to wear to a state dinner, let alone to bed. As she surveyed him, he seemed to feel her gaze upon him, and turned to look, then went a little red and smiled. "Looking sharp today," she observed with a grin. "I figured you'd have fallen asleep in your workshop and still be wearing the same clothes as Tuesday." He chuckled a little shyly and said, "Only the best for Christmas morning." She rummaged around under the tree and found a pair of packages that she hadn't seen before, labeled for her, from him. They were both wrapped in the same gold paper, the small flat one secured at the top of the big blocky one with a broad cross of red ribbon surmounted by a bow. The blocky one was quite heavy, not too heavy to lift, but heavy enough that, sitting on the floor as she was, Utrina preferred to slide it across the rug for a closer look. "Open the little one first," Corwin told her. "Okay," she said, untied the bow and tore the end off the smaller package's wrapping paper. The package, which proved to be a white cardboard box about 8 by 3 by 1/2 inches, slid out easily. She held it in one hand and removed the lid with the other. Inside was the wristwatch she'd seen the day before, disassembled, on a bench in Corwin's underground workshop. It was complete now, a big, round, expensive-looking analog chronometer, with a timer bezel, separate little dials for the sweep second and day, and a little window for the date. "Wow," said Utrina. "Neat. Sturdy-looking, too," she added, strapping it to her wrist and holding it out to admire it. "I've never had very good luck with watches, but this one looks like it'll be able to keep up with me," she said with a grin. "Thanks." Corwin smiled and said, "Turn the bezel to 30. "Okay," said Utrina, complying. "Now press in that stud there at 4 o'clock. 4 o'clock. Got it." With a click and a whir, the face of the watch swung upward on a hinge like the lid of a tiny portable computer, revealing a circular display panel and a speaker grill. The stud at 2 o'clock slid outward, revealing itself to be a small telescopic antenna which jutted up at a jaunty angle. Utrina raised her eyebrows. "Two-way wrist TV?" she inquired with a smile. "Not quite," Corwin replied. By now everyone else had stopped what they were doing to watch, his siblings being familiar enough with Corwin's gift presentations by now to know that something neat was probably coming up. "Say your name into the speaker," said Corwin. Utrina gave him a cocked eyebrow look, but raised the watch anyway and, feeling a bit foolish, said firmly, "Utrina Tenjo." The watch beeped, whirred, beeped again, and then gave a series of cascading tones that sounded rather pleased with themselves. The large, blocky box vibrated a bit, then made a noise that was halfway between a hydraulic sound and an animal's growl. The side of the box suddenly dented outward with a startling whang. Then it did it again, a bit to the right. A third time in the center bulged the box's side far enough for the silvery metal to tear through the paper. Then, with one final impact, the whole side of the box broke away from the rest and fell to the floor. Wisps of steam escaped from the open side of the box, and then, with measured tread, something emerged. It was another robot, about the same size as Lesser Mazinger, but of a completely different style. Where Lesser Mazinger was all smooth armor and sleek lines, black, dark blue, and silver, this robot was built along bulkier lines and in an older-fashioned style, with rows of what looked like rivets studding its gray armor in bright red accents. Its barrel chest and massive shoulders had scarlet plates, and rivet-studded red cuffs ringed its wrists and ankles. Its head had a glowering human face and a red and gray pharaonic headdress motif happening. On its back, a pair of what appeared to be rocket thrusters rode like a set of Aqualung tanks. The robot strode across the plate it had knocked out of the side of its box, its steps pressing footprints into the thin metal, then out onto the carpet, where it paused, looked around, and placed its hands on its armor-kilted hips as if to say, "Well, now what?" Lesser Mazinger, who had been loitering near Caitlin, took notice of this newcomer and marched over to investigate. For a long beat, the two robots stood, perhaps 6 inches apart, surveying each other. Utrina and Caitlin both broke up laughing at the sight. "Utrina Tenjo," said Corwin proudly when his audience had regained her breath, "meet Tiny Robo." Hearing its name, Tiny Robo turned. Utrina leaned forward and picked it up by either side of its rounded torso, noting as she did so that it had a satisfyingly substantial weight to it. It didn't object to this treatment by its new owner, merely put its hands on her wrists to steady itself, and regarded her with its permanent pharaoh's scowl. She peered closely at its face. Its tiny eyes, perhaps the size of pinheads, irised with a minuscule servo sound, focusing on her in turn. "Wow," Uchna repeated. "His eyes must have taken you hours." "Dorothy had to help me calibrate them," Corwin admitted. "Her hands are steadier than mine." "Hello there, tiny robo," said Uterna cheerfully, setting the robot back down on the rug. "It's nice to meet you." "Like Lesser Mazinger for Kate, he's programmed to obey your instructions and protect you as best he can. He can record whatever he sees and hears. I'll show you how to retrieve his logs and stuff later. And knows a bunch of basic games. His AI is pretty advanced, especially for his size, so he can learn new things, too. He and Lesser Mazinger can keep each other company when you and Kate are out." Tiny Robo turned and went back to where Lesser Mazinger stood, arms folded. The two robots regarded each other for a few seconds more. Then Lesser Mazinger stuck out his hand, and Tiny Robo, with comical solemnity, shook it. "Looks like they're going to be friends," Kate observed with a chuckle. "What's the watch for?" Uchna wondered. "It's a control system. You can give Robo commands with it if he's out of earshot, and the display shows you what he's looking at, see? He can home in on you if you're wearing it, too." Corwin gave his sister an apologetic look. "I tried to get a similar system working for Lesser Maz, but to fit the receiver into his brain casing, I'd have had to leave out a lot of his AI functions. Pitfalls of designing to a pre-existing form factor." That's okay, Corwin," Kate assured him, smiling. "I love him anyway." "Wow, Corwin," said Guy as Lesser Mazinger and Tiny Robo locked their hands together and began a classic contest of robot strength. "You make the best robots. When I'm a big-time space hero, build me one, okay? A big one." Corwin laughed and ruffled his half-brother's hair. "Sure thing, Guy. You make the big time, I'll build you the strongest robot in the world." Griffin sighed theatrically. "Most people's kids want to grow up to be firefighters or doctors. Mine want to be space heroes." "It's natural for kids to want to emulate their parents, Mr. Hutchins," said Uchna, smiling. "I suppose you've got a point, Miss Tenjo," Griffin replied. "You don't have to call me that," she said. "Just Uchna is fine." "Quit calling me Mr. Hutchins and we'll talk," said Griffin with a grin. "Oh, wow," said Pris. "Sylph, check it out! A triple draw holster for my needler! Thanks, Dad!" "Cool," Sylvie agreed, crowding closer to her friend for a better look. "That's the kind with the spring catch in it?" "Right, you can strap it to your arm and then pop! Someone's in for a bad afternoon." "Awesome!" Kay and Griffin exchanged slightly dubious smiles. "At least it means you never have to set foot in the Barbie aisle," Kay pointed out. "True, true," Griffin replied. "Hey, Corwin, these guys are going to rip each other's arms off if they keep this up," Nall announced, standing a safe distance back from the two straining robots. "Nah," said Corwin, "they're just playing. They're programmed to cool it if there's any risk of damage." "Remarkable," Miki observed, tripping his watch. "You built them yourself?" "With my own two hands. Well, and Dorothy's," Corwin confirmed. "It's a hobby of mine. I like robots." "Where is Dorothy?" Uterna wondered. "You'd think she'd come up for Christmas, at least." She looked discomfited then, as if it had just struck her that she might have stepped in a hole, and she added in a more hesitant tone, unless that's, you know, not allowed or something. Sort of skimmed the chapter about domestic robots. "Oh, no, she has the run of the place," Corwin assured her. "She's just kind of shy. I usually go down after lunch, and we have our own little Christmas in the workshop." He sighed, shaking his head. "I wish she could make friends more easily, but, well, you saw what she's like with strangers." Uchna chuckled. "You sound like a worried parent. Maybe you should send her away to school." Corwin gave her an odd look, but before he could reply, Leonard drew everyone's attention with his delighted reaction to the master-grade model kit of an Imperator-class Star Destroyer he'd just uncovered, and the morning moved on. For someone who had appeared unheralded on the morning of Christmas Eve, Miki came away with a pretty respectable haul, a data crystal player and a small but comprehensive sampling of Kate's favorite music, all across her wide band of musical likes. He had to be reassured that no one was holding it against him, that he hadn't been able to do much shopping, but he was starting to learn. He only had to be told once. After all the gifts were opened and the wreckage of paper and boxes disposed of, the company dispersed to their respective rooms to get themselves presentable for the rest of the day.
I never gave you a tour,
Caitlin mused to Utena as the latter emerged from Kate's bathroom, shrugging into one of her black jackets. No, Utena replied, grinning. You didn't. She went to the desk, picked up the watch Corwin gave her, and strapped it on.
Going to have to get used to wearing one of these again, she noted, admiring it.
Kate smiled and hopped up from her bed.
Want that tour now?
Sure. She'd already seen most of the house. Kate showed her the bits she hadn't managed to explore yet, including Griffin's study, a pleasant L-shaped room that took up about half of the third floor, the rest being Kate's room, the master bedroom, and a couple of unused rooms. The room back beyond the den on the ground floor, which appeared to be more or less another den, and the basement. This last was a nice place, no dank catacomb, but rather a finished and furnished space with a pool table, a bubble hockey machine like the one they'd had such a good time with at the Hockey Hall of Fame, chairs, and an old but functional stereo system. It was the kind of room, Caitlin explained, that parents put together so they could banish their teenage children to it and have the upstairs in peace. From there, they put on their coats and went out into the backyard. This was much larger than the front yard, several times bigger than the area of the house itself, and enclosed entirely by a sturdy-looking stockade fence. There were several cleared paths through the snowdrifts, one leading to each of the two outbuildings standing there, and a couple more that seemed to just meander around. One of the outbuildings was a big, dark wooden structure. Kate informed Utena that there was a swimming pool inside it. The other was smaller, and seemed, at a glance, to be made of paper and wood, not unlike the way some buildings were made back in Sephiro. In fact, it was quite familiar indeed, and Utena suspected she knew what it was before Kate led her over to it and slid open one of the wall panels.
Dojo, they said together, and Kate grinned. Seen them before, eh?
Sayanji was the captain of the Kendo Club back home, remember? The school had one of these. She chuckled nostalgically. That was where I challenged him to that first duel, as a matter of fact. Stole one of their practice swords, too. She looked around at the neatly racked weapons, the brightly polished floor, the serene order of the place.
How come it's warm?
Special paper, Kate replied, thumping one of the walls with a fingertip. Oh, said Utena. Kate closed the door, and they walked around the path.
There's a rock garden under all this snow, she said, gesturing vaguely.
Off to one side of the dojo, a pool of water about 10 feet across, enclosed by a low stone wall, steamed gently in the chill of the wintry morning. Utena went and looked down in it, and laughed to see a half-dozen fat golden carp swimming serenely around, unaware that the temperature just above their artificial hot spring was at least 15 degrees below freezing.
Nuclear fusion is a wonderful thing, Kate observed with mock reverence as she came up beside Utena and surveyed the pond.
Sure, it powers starships and makes galactic commerce possible, but more importantly, it lets Dad keep tropical fish outdoors in winter!
Utena whirled, puzzled, as her roommate's last word spiraled up into a yowl, to see Kate dancing an odd little dance, trying to reach behind her with both arms and not really succeeding.
Finally, she gave that up and spun around,
fists clenched, face flushed, to see Nall winging his way back toward Corwin, who stood at the bend of the path near the corner of the dojo, dressed for the outdoors. Or rather, trying to wing his way back toward Corwin. Nall was actually giggling too hard to fly straight.
"You'll pay for that, dragon," Kate declared,
and, bending, she scooped up a handful of snow, packed it, and let fly. She was no Coco Martinez, Utuna noted, but she didn't throw like a girl all the same. The missile missed its intended target, but it splattered Corwin pretty solidly. Corwin blinked through the snow suddenly encrusting his face, then slowly raised a hand and, very deliberately, wiped it away from his eyes. Below them, it split to reveal a sly and growing grin. He set his teeth and whistled through them. On either side of the path, like ninja rising from mist, Pris and Sylvie raised themselves from behind snow-covered rocks.
"Oh, this is slag," muttered Kate.
She and Utrina glanced at each other, then dove in opposite directions, behind the large boulder next to the koi pond, just before the first salvo impacted their cover. The battle was joined, and it was glorious. Though outnumbered, Kate and Utrina were far from outclassed. Kate had a good eye for area effect. She could make apparent misses turn into collateral hits by gauging the splatter radius of her fire. As for Utna, she had to throw from the stretch, her full windup leaving her too open a target, but who cared if her fastball lacked a bit of its normal velocity? It was all about coming in over the plate in this particular game. Guy wandered outside after a bit, having heard all the shouting and trash-talking and gotten curious about what it was all for. He endeavored to remain neutral, but inevitably got drawn in on the side of evil, and then it was 4-2. Nall, having started the melee in the first place, retired to Corwin's shoulder and confined himself to talking smack in the general direction of the embattled roommates.
The situation is not improving, Kate observed, ducking a salvo from Corwin and Pris and tagging her brother nicely with her return fire.
"Keep them busy for a second," Utrina replied, slipping fully down behind the rock. She keyed open her watch, grinned, and called,
"Tiny Robo, round up Lesser Mazinger and anybody else you can find and get to the backyard, pronto!"
replied the watch. A few moments later, the cavalry arrived. If two toy robots and a confused pianist can really be considered cavalry. Mickey Kaworu, trotting along behind the two flying robots with puzzlement on his face, figured out pretty fast what was going on when the forces of evil gave shouts of delight and aimed all their fire at him. Yelping in consternation, he broke into a run, dashing across the path and throwing himself behind Kate and Utina's boulder.
"Hiya, Mickey,"
said Utina, handing him the snowball she'd just finished packing.
"Glad you could join us. Do me a favor and see if you can take out Daniels. She's got a wicked slider."
Lesser Mazinger and Tiny Robo took the fight to the enemy without delay. Taking up stations in front of the boulder, they ignored enemy fire entirely as they diligently rolled up snowballs almost as big as they were, then delivered them in their own unique ways. Lesser Mazinger hoisted his between his hands, aimed carefully, and then launched both hands on their rocket thrusters, the snowball still clamped between them, to smack soundly into Corwin's chest. Tiny Robo simply hefted his and heaved it like a shot putter, lobbing it into a high, hard arc that smashed down quite satisfyingly atop Pris's head.
"Why, you!" Nall cried, and launched himself at Lesser Mazinger.
The black and blue robot, undaunted, recalled his hands, deployed his flight wings, and the two began an intricate dogfight in the skies above the battle proper. Mickey looked down at the snowball Utina had given to him, peeked around the rock at the enemy position, then smiled and handed it back.
"I won't need this," he said, and then went to the edge of the rock.
"Cover me."
Utina gave him a puzzled look, then grinned and rounded the rock.
"Go,"
she said, and delivered a punishing double shot to keep Sylvie's head down. Mickey went, darting to the right of the dojo and disappearing behind it.
"Kaworu's trying to flank us," Corwin declared. "Sylv, go get him."
"My pleasure, boss," Sylvie replied with a grin.
She went the other way, back along the dojo wall, figuring to intercept Miki as he rounded the far side in his attempt to get behind the forces of evil.
"Give it up, Ravenhair," Utna called from behind the boulder. "Don't make me come over there and give you a whitewash."
"I'd like to see you try," Corwin replied. "I'd have you eating snow before you could say lemon flavor, please."
"Oh, is that so?" Utna replied. "Is that a challenge, I hear? You know, I used to be a duelist."
"Snowballs at 20 paces? Face it, Tenjo, you're outclassed. It was a nice touch turning my creations against me, but I've got all the advantages. Better position, better snow, more troops."
"Bigger mouth," Utna replied, then whipped out from her cover and let him have it.
"Gah!" he declared, sputtering.
"Crush them now, Tiny Robo,"
Utna declared, pointing dramatically. Tiny Robo hefted a new snowball, this about the size of a decent bowling ball, and hurled it square into Corwin's chest. Already unbalanced by Utna's salvo, he let out a despairing yawp and crashed backward into a drift.
Charge!
Kate bellowed, rounding the other side of the rock. Tiny Robo declined to obey this instruction, instead hanging back to provide supporting fire, as Utna and Caitlin dashed across no man's land, and the battle shifted from ranged fire to the brutal realities of hand-to-hand combat. Leonard emerged from the house at that point, new Bokuto in hand, and decided he wouldn't try to get to the dojo until the backyard stopped giggling and writhing. Somehow, Caitlin managed to subdue both the twins, despite the fact that Guy was now fully involved and struggling with all his heroic might. That left Corwin to Utna, and before too long she had him by the hair, her knee in the middle of his back, levering his face toward a patch of undisturbed snow.
"Well," she said with a grin that threatened to split her face outright.
Corwin heaved himself up a little, but his knee slipped in the snow and spilled him back down again. The tip of his nose touched the snow.
"Well?" Utna repeated.
Before Corwin could reply, or mount another escape attempt, whichever he was planning to do, a blue, black, and white blur spiraled past, pitched upward, and then plummeted with a distressed yowl into the koi pond.
"Whoa!"
Utna remarked, letting up on Corwin's head. The pond flared with a bright yellow light. For a second, Utna had the frightful thought that Lesser Mazinger had exploded or something. But then the light rayed brightly upward, collapsed into a beam, and a woman popped up out of the surface of the pond. She was tall and slim, with jet-black hair almost as long as she was tall. It was thick and straight, gathered into a tremendous ponytail, the group of narrow forelocks flying free to frame her wide-eyed, high-cheekboned face. She resembled Corwin, the bits of Corwin that didn't look like his father, and had markings on her face similar to his, the same triangles on her cheekbones, and a heavy, open-centered oblong mark on her forehead. She had jingling golden earrings made of clusters of memory rods, and was dressed all in white and red, with a splendid, white fur-trimmed red overcoat and boots. In one hand she held Lesser Mazinger, in the other a very wet and bedraggled-looking Gnoll.
"Hello, everyone," she declared,
then looked around with a bemused expression before finally settling on Corwin's rather interesting-looking predicament.
"I'm sorry, have I come at a bad time?"
she asked with an impish grin. She walked across the surface of the no longer glowing pond, hopped down from the edge of the stone wall, and stood grinning as Corwin scrambled to his feet, brushed snow from himself, and assured her that she hadn't. "As a matter of fact, your timing couldn't be better," he told her with a smirk. "Mom, this is Caitlin's school roommate, Utna Tenjo. Utna, my mother, Skuld Ravenhair." Skuld turned her smile on Utna, who was bowing. "You were about to give my son a whitewash, weren't you?" she inquired.
Well, yes," said Utna. "But I beat him fair and square. He deserved it."
"I see," said Skuld, nodding. "Well, in that case, you'd better be about it. I don't want him thinking I'm going to bail him out of all his troubles. He's too old for that sort of thing," she said pleasantly. Utna blinked at her, then grinned, turned, grabbed a flabbergasted Corwin by the front of his coat, and snuffed out his hurt cry of, "Mom!" with that patch of snow that had his name on it.
Now then, Utina said briskly as she led him, sputtering and wiping at his eyes, back up off the ground. Where'd Miki get off to?
Miki, where are you?
Momentarily, Miki appeared around the far corner of the dojo, not a hair out of place, smiling placidly, and leading before him a very red-faced and wet-haired Sylvie Daniels with his hand on the scruff of her neck. Now, are you going to be a good girl? He asked her indulgently. For now, she replied petulantly. Can we go inside before I freeze solid? Nall inquired. I mean, I like snow and ice and all. I'm a white dragon, but there are limits. Miki was introduced. Everybody picked themselves up and dusted themselves off, and the crowd adjourned. The twins and a still-shaken Sylvie went roaring off to make trouble somewhere else, probably down the street. Leonard, finally able to pass, said his smiling hello to Skuld and entered the dojo for his morning kata. The rest of them went to the living room for mugs of hot cocoa, while Nall basked on the hearthstones in front of the fire to dry out. What did you do to Sylvie? Utina murmured to Miki as he sat down on the couch next to her. Something Kozue did to me once when Dad took us skiing, he replied. She called it the frozen punishment, though I forget exactly what she was punishing me for. I don't think I want the details. Your sister's got a major mean streak. I hadn't noticed, Miki replied dryly. Corwin came back downstairs from putting on dry clothes, having taken the second worst pounding of the whole engagement, collected a mug of cocoa from the tray by the kitchen arch, and looked for somewhere to park. Utina patted the free third of the couch to her left. No hard feelings? She asked with a conciliatory smile. Corwin put his cocoa down on the end table and grinned. Like you said, you beat me fair and square, he replied, moving to take the offered seat.
Ahem, said Skuld with a look of mock petulance. I seem to recall somebody was too busy getting his face scrubbed to greet his mother properly.
Corwin prudently aborted the seating operation and went to give his mother a hug and kiss hello instead. Not until that moment had it occurred to Utina that Skuld's arrival had been at all weird. She'd read that the technology existed here for teleporting machines. Did Kate's dad have one built into his artificial hot spring? That'd be strange, but then he was a bit eccentric, in a charming kind of way. She liked this whole family, weird parts and all. She decided not to worry about it as Corwin finally took his assigned place and reclaimed his cocoa. Kate came from the kitchen, where she'd opted to make herself some mint tea instead of the cocoa, and sat down on the floor in front of the sofa, smiling.
Dad's doing pizza for lunch, she reported.
All right, said Corwin.
On Christmas? Said Utina dubiously.
It's only lunch, Skuld pointed out, plunking down in the big brown armchair.
She, too, looked much younger than she had to be, not that much older than Kate. Around the same age, Utina reflected, as, say, Sionji. Skuld and Corwin could have been siblings separated by a handful of years, like Kate and Pris, rather than mother and son. The concentration of these youthful immortals in this area was starting to feel more than a little surreal, as if Utina had slipped into some kind of bizarre Peter Pan world where the grown-ups had figured out a way to do it that didn't force them to leave Never Neverland. The five of them chatted about this and that, the rather odd circumstances of Mickey's arrival, which Corwin hadn't heard about before, the midnight mass, the state of things back on Tomodachi, where Skuld made her home. Corwin's mother took a few minutes to examine the robots he'd made and was duly impressed.
This is excellent work, she noted, looking over Tiny Robo. Let's see your power core, little guy. Come on.
With an obliging growl, Tiny Robo opened his plastron, revealing a startling maze of tiny pipes and conduits.
Steam pile. Very nice. Love the tubing. Seems a bit overpowered for a toy, though.
Future expansion, Corwin explained.
Of course, said Skuld. Okay, TR, you can close up shop, she said, and released the robot back to the floor.
Smart design. Very good work. You must have been really motivated, she added, a twinkle in her eye.
I always try to do my best work, Corwin replied piously, his cheeks going a little red.
Of course, Skuld repeated. Utina?
Yes'm, said Utina, looking attentive.
I can't reach from over here, said Skuld, and the fire's making me too lazy to get up. Mess up Corwin's hair for me, would you?
My pleasure, said Utina, and she did that thing. Caitlin giggled. Corwin sighed, but not in a manner that indicated he was suffering.